This is Joe Burns.
And Chad P.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Rock School Podcast.
We think you'll learn something.
Now remember, if you want to hear the show with all the music in place, go to KSLU.org and stream the show live, Thursdays at 5.
And Sundays at 4.
It's a new show every week.
Now enjoy this week's Rock School Radio Show.
Portions of the day's programming are reproduced by means of electrical transcriptions or tape recordings.
It's time for school. Rock School. With your hosts, Dr. Joe Burns and Chad P.
And then picks himself up a job at Screen Gems. Screen Gems?
What are Screen Gems?
Screen Gems. Television? Screen Gems? Any idea?
No.
Here we come, walking down the street.
Huh?
Monkeys.
Class is in.
Broadcasting live from a mall fountain that we fell into while texting.
It's dangerous, Chad.
It's very dangerous.
It's dangerous. People are laughing at us.
Hey, I could have walked into a car.
I could have walked into a ditch.
I could have walked into a bus.
That was driving over me while I was in the ditch. What an idiot. I got to tell you.
And now she's lawyering up.
I know. She wants to sue this place because she says people are laughing at us.
Right.
You know, if she'd have just laughed at herself, she could have come out of this thing and said, I'm sorry I was texting. I fell into this fountain. I'm an idiot. Make an NBC movie of the week out of
right.
it. Could have made some bread out of it, but no. Here's somebody that made a lot of bread, a lot of cheddar, a lot of cheese. Don Kirshner.
Boy, that he did.
Don Kirshner passed away of heart failure January 17th at age 76 in Boca Raton, Florida.
So that was just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago. I'm a little behind the time because of the way the death fell and the mm-hmm. way we record our shows. But the man with the golden ear, by the way, the only guy, the only American with rights to the ATV Kirshner Corporation catalog. Any idea? North American Publishing. Any idea who that's owning? Beatles.
Beatles.
Beatles and the John Lennon catalog.
Ooh.
So this guy made a little bit of coin.
Yeah.
He's also responsible for You Lost That Love and Feeling, the song that has the most plays of any song on the radio.
8 million plus.
That's right. Also, Where the Boys Are, which mm-hmm. started the spring break Florida craze, you know, mm-hmm. jump in the car and drive down to Florida right there at the end of your spring semester.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, over the next hour, if you don't know who Don Kirshner is, let me tell you about Don Kirshner. He was a music publisher. Basically responsible for the concept of the Brill Building, mm-hmm. the Monkees, and what a lot of people know him for, Don Kirshner's rock concert. Let me give you his history as much as you can in an hour, introduce you to the man. Here's his first published song. He was working as a bellhop in the Catskills one summer when he runs into a guy named Frankie Lane, who was a singer at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Says, Frankie, I've written this song for you. Frankie Lane says, look, I don't want to record your song, but kid, I'll tell you how you get it published. And he follows the steps that Frankie Lane gives him, and boom, he gets the song published.
Mm-hmm.
It never actually is recorded, but he gets the song published, and that basically puts in his mind, maybe publishing is the way to go.
Okay.
Later on, he has his first writing success. In 1957, he meets a guy by the name of Robert Casado in, of all places, a candy store. You know, nice American story there. After hearing this guy play and sing some original material that Kirshner creates, he says, we should be a team. And after a year, you know, waiting for their
for the big
deal
break.
To
yeah.
come their way, it never does. And Casado shakes his hand and says, you know, you go do what you want to do. I'm going to take off this way. But it's through Kirshner that Casado basically gets his in
okay.
in the music industry.
Right.
Any idea who Robert Casado is?
No, I've never heard of the man.
Well, he changes his name once he has a little bit of success.
Okay.
Changes it to...
To what?
Bobby Darin.
Casado is Bobby Darin?
That's right. And he goes on to record a slew of them. Here's one of the biggies, Mac the Knife. Back school.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear. And it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has a...
Look out, old Mac is back!
This is Rock School, looking at the years in the life of Don Kirshner.
Look out, old Mackie is back.
That's right.
I love that
song. It really is.
Did you ever hear the version that Robbie Williams did?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. It really is.
Very, very good.
We're now in 1958, talking about Don Kirshner. Kirshner meets a guy by the name of Al Nevins.
Nevins.
And he sells Al Nevins on the idea that the money is not in writing the music, the money is in publishing it.
What's the difference?
Well, instead of writing it where you would get a fee just song to song, you wrote the song, here's your fee, and maybe some royalties down the road.
Sure.
If you own the rights to the song, if you publish it, not only do you get a fee when the song is recorded, every single solitary time that song is played on the radio, on the stage, it's picked up in a commercial, anytime, you are the publisher. You're the people they pay. And then out of your money, it distributes out to those that have something to do with the song, like the mechanical royalties, they who played the music, that kind of thing.
So obviously,
well, there's much more money.
Publishing's where the bread is.
That's right. So he sells this guy, Al Nevins, on the concept that we should publish music, but we should specifically publish music for a teenage audience because they are voracious. They will eat and buy music like nobody's business. Al says okie dokie, and they start Aldon Music, A-L-D-O-N.
Aldon.
Okay. Aldon, get it?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Aldon Music gets started at 1650 Broadway, directly across the street from the Brill Building. Now remember, the Brill Building starts as a clothing store.
That's right.
No more are these two guys unpacking their boxes to basically say, okay, we're open for business. Two guys show up at their doorstep, Howard Greenfield and Neil Sedaka. As in, Neil Sedaka, as in Calendar Girl. They walk in with a whole bunch of music, say, okay, we hear you're a brand new record label. We're looking for a publishing contract. Okay, play us some of the music. So they play six songs for Kirshner. Don Kirshner says, these aren't bad. Let me take these to a friend of mine by the name of Connie Francis. Okay. Connie Francis listens to all of these songs and said, I kind of like that one right there called Stupid Cupid. They take this song, record it. This is all happening within like 3 weeks.
Right, right.
They take this song, record it, and in October of 1958, Stupid Cupid, which literally fell out of the clear blue sky into their laps, goes to number 17, and they officially sign Sedaka and Greenfield, and those two guys become the beginning of what will get known as the Brill Building Machine.
Cool deal.
Here is Connie Francis with the Sedaka Greenfield penned Stupid Cupid on Rock School.
Stupid Cupid, you're a real mean guy. I'd like to clip your wings so you can fly.
Stupid Cupid.
I'm in love and it's a crying shame.
Stupid Cupid.
And I know that you're the one to blame.
Stupid Cupid.
Stupid Cupid. Now back up. Here's my question to you. When Kirshner and Nevins were there unpacking, as you said, these guys walked in with these stack of
Sedaka and Greenfield,
How did they even know that they were there?
Oh,
I mean,
I got
if they were only in that place long enough to, you know, get the water cooler set up.
Take my word for it. I got to believe in the world of music. If there's a new place to possibly sell your music, I have to believe if you're in the know. Hey, look, there's this new place called Aldon Music. All right, let's go.
Okay.
Let's be the first people there.
About to say.
If new radio station was showing up in Hammond.
We'd know.
Yeah, believe me. Before they threw the switch, there would be six or seven guys there. You need an afternoon guy?
Gotcha. Okay.
All right.
Fair enough.
It's now 1962. And the Sedaka and Greenfield have written something like six hits for Connie Francis. And by 62, Aldon Music has got a staff of 18 people writing for them.
Hey.
And it's Brill Building. It is now, you know, there's magic in the air, Brill Building. What they have are what you'd think. It's a machine system. You've got little cubicle rooms with a piano in the corner, and people are sitting there churning out song after song after song. And Aldon Music is selling them to the people of the day, publishing them out.
I thought it was across the street from
the
Brill Building.
It was across the street. They were buying space up in this Brill Building.
Oh, in the Brill Building.
Right, that's where it was. There was a clothing store on the first floor.
Sewing going on the first floor and writing on the second to up.
You're right. And they just keep doing it and selling these songs that are being recorded to places like Columbia, Decca, and Capitol to release them.
Now, they're writing and getting them published, or they're just writing?
They're writing them, publishing through Alden, and then getting them released and distributed through places like Decca, Columbia, Capitol. Oh, this guy was a genius. He didn't even do his own distribution.
And if these songs take off anywhere close to the charts,
right,
lots of money coming in.
To him, which he then distributes back to the writers.
Right.
You got it.
Wow.
How about that?
It's like a little mini empire.
It's a machine. It absolutely is. Now, the bulk of the hits were by these three teams that he had. You've already met one of them, Sedaka Greenfield.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is Goffin King,
okay,
as in Carole King and her husband, Mr. Goffin. They had the first number one out of the Brill Building. We mentioned it earlier on, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow by the Shirelles. But other ones, The Locomotion by Little Eva.
They wrote that?
Oh, yeah. Locomotion by Little Eva, by the way, was Carole King's babysitter. it was. Take Good Care of My Baby, Bobby V. Crying in the Rain, The Everly Brothers. Don't Say Nothing Bad About My Baby. Oh, no. By The Cookies. Up on the Roof, The Drifters. And this one, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. Classic by Aretha Franklin.
Seriously?
This is nothing. I can't even begin to give you the list of what came out of the Brill Building.
Wow.
It's insane. Here's Aretha Franklin with one by Goffin King. Right here, Rock School.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired.
You know, one thing that I did fail to mention.
What's that?
I talked about the fact that he was using a secondary labels to distribute his stuff.
Yeah.
He actually did have a distribution of his own, a label called Dimension.
Uh-huh.
And he did do some of his own stuff, like The Cookies, some Little Eva stuff. And when Carole King decided to start producing her own music, he did some of little Carole King music. But other than that, about 13, 14 releases. Most of it was done by major stuff.
Now you
but
said
he did do some distribution on his
own. Sorry, you said that the Kings were the first ones to produce the first number one.
Well, Goffin King.
Goffin King, okay.
Right.
So the first team of writers that they have in there, they're writing, and they get up to number 17, but Goffin King comes in, and his gets up to number one.
Right.
Would that first team of writers see any of that royalty money?
Oh, no.
Not at
all?
They
were in competition with one another.
So they're all up there kind of like independently competing. So like if I'm on the third floor writing and you're on the sixth floor writing, my song makes it to number five, yours makes it to number three.
Oh, I don't know. My writing has nothing to do with you. In fact, a lot of this I got from the Brill Building book. And the writers, except for this three groups of two that I'm going to tell you about, you've met two of them already. A lot of writers came in, did a little bit of writing, and were gone because
really?
They wouldn't produce.
Oh.
I mean, Donald Fagen and Walter Becker actually did writing at the Brill Building.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's a lot of people that went in, did nothing, and were gone.
Wow.
Because you didn't go in and do like a, you know, at the end of the night when the waiters and the waitresses all pool the money together and split the tips.
What's my take
on
today?
No. Oh, heck no. If you wrote, you wrote.
You had to be in competition.
You got it.
Hey, Joe, I just went number one. Ha!
Yeah, drop dead.
Okay.
The third little grouping of two was Synthony Man and Barry Weil.
Uh-huh.
Now, I know they've come up on the show before, but let me tell you some of the ones they wrote. Don't Know Much, Aaron Neville, Linda Ronstadt. I know you know that one.
I sure do.
Here You Come Again, Dolly Parton. Hungry, Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Mm-hmm.
Running with the Night, Lionel Richie.
Oh,
Just
God,
Once,
dude.
James Ingram, Quincy Jones.
These are all awesome hits.
Monster. And again, I could list forever. These are just some of the monsters. And this one, George Benson. They Say the Neon Lights Are Bright
on Broadway.
That's right. Here you go. Rock School.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway. They say there's always magic in the air.
This is Rock School as we talk about Don Kirshner, and we are right in the middle of his work with the Brill Building. We got just a little bit of time before the bottom of the hour, and I got a fun song for you to get to the bottom of the hour.
Mm-hmm.
Real quickly, Don Kirshner, at the height of all of this in 1963, sells it all.
Why?
Sells it all. Sells the entire operation to Columbia. Gone.
Oh.
And then picks himself up a job at Screen Gems. Screen Gems?
What are Screen Gems?
Screen Gems. Television. Screen Gems? Any idea?
No.
Here we come, walking down the street.
Huh?
Monkeys. This is how Don Kirshner gets hooked up with the Monkees.
Monkees.
Believe it or not. Now, believe it or not, all this stuff was happening, as you probably know. The Brill Building was on the East Coast, New York City.
Yeah.
There was a West Coast office, a Kirshner West Coast office, which was specifically headed up by a guy named Lou Adler, right? I'll tell you one of the things Lou Adler did right after the break, and then we'll start with the monkey stuff after that. Hello, KLSU. Thanks for running the radio show.
Hello, KSCL in Shreveport, Louisiana, the location of Louisiana's Brill Building.
How about that? I had no idea.
Oh, yeah, it's right there on Main Street.
Get us on Facebook. Search Rock School Radio Show. We're late.
Main Street.
Oh, yeah. Back in a minute on Rock School. Okay, before we get into the monkeys,
what's a fun song?
Real quick, Kirshner's West Coast office was headed up by Lou Adler.
Okay.
He would manage Jan and Dean and head up Dunhill Records, amongst a bunch of other little tiny labels.
Yes.
But one thing they didn't do on the East Coast, they would do movies on the West Coast and deal with the music of movies on the West Coast. I looked at the list of movies that they dealt with in the Kirshner West Coast office.
What did they do?
Thought you might find this one interesting.
Which one?
The Rocky Horror Picture Show.
The Time Warp!
Let's do it again!
Woo!
Rock School.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll. But listen closely.
Okay, bottom of the hour on Rock School. My name is Joe Burns.
I'm Chad P.
And we're going to do a quick break, do 7 days and 70 seconds, come back and keep talking about Don Kirshner. These dates, Monday, January 24th through Sunday, January 30th. Monday, Chad, go.
January 24th in 1941, the world-renowned singer and songwriter Neil Diamond was born in Brooklyn.
By the way, Neil Diamond wrote Brill Building.
Yeah.
And wrote a couple songs that the Monkees recorded and had hits with it. Because it was, yeah, we see, all in a nice
it all comes
bow.
Full circle.
It does, it's a nice pink bow. 25th of January, Tuesday, back in 1964, Phil Spector is a guest judge on Jukebox Jury in the UK, which plays new songs and asks the judges to predict whether they would become hits or not.
Jukebox Jury would later become American Idol.
Yeah.
January 26th in 1956, the legendary Buddy Holly records for the first time with Decca Records.
Thursday, January 27th, 1991, 20 years ago, the Star Spangled Banner is performed by Whitney Houston at the Super Bowl.
And she will always love us.
Yeah.
January 28th, again, 1956, Elvis the Pelvis makes his national television debut on CBS's The Dorsey Brothers stage show.
January 29th, that's a Saturday, 1979, San Diego schoolgirl Brenda Spencer shoots and kills a school principal and a custodian, wounds 9 others. Her explanation for the shooting? I don't like Mondays. Bob Geldof and the Boomtown Rats would write a song of the same title. Mm. And January 30th, that's a Sunday, in 1973, Kiss makes their live stage debut at the Coventry Club in Queens, New York.
Was that the show for three people?
No, that was at the Popcorn Club.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In November of 1965.
I'm flabbergasted. Monkeys? Why did he leave?
Oh, well, you'll hear. The pilot of The Monkees was shot. The screen test was disastrous. The show was re-edited and it tested a little better, and The Monkees were signed on for 32 shows. Now, originally, The Monkees played all their own instruments. However, Don Kirshner was brought in by Screen Gems after the original screen tests, and he put a stop to it all.
Why?
Because the tests were so bad.
Oh.
He came in and he said, I'm going to make you guys stars, but you got to do what I want to do. The thing is, when Kirshner signed on, he said, I get one-third of every royalty assigned to the Monkees. So every Monkee song that ever played, no matter what bit of money it makes, Don Kirshner gets one-third of it. Furthermore, the Monkees' music had absolutely no choice in what they sang, how they sang it, who played the music, what songs were chosen. Don Kirshner had full creative control.
Wow.
You can imagine this upset them just a little
bit. Kushner wants us to sing it in C. I want to do it in B.
Yeah, probably. Here's the Monkees, the theme at least, and when we come back, I'll tell you the whole story about how it all just went to heck. Monkees, Rock School.
Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the Monkees, and people say we're monkeys.
Okay, the song you just heard, Theme from the Monkees, was written by two guys, Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart. They were brought in as the original producers of the Monkees.
Right.
Kirshner didn't like them. Got rid of them. The problem is he then brought in a British guy named Snuff Garrett. They didn't work with him. Mm-hmm. Hated him. Got rid of him. Brought in Goffin and King. Remember them from the Brill Building?
Sure do.
Didn't work with them. Fired them.
Are you serious?
Brought in a couple other people. Fired them.
To write, correct?
No, to actually produce the Monkees.
To produce
However,
everything.
Goffin and King did write some songs for the Monkees. Didn't work. Brought in a couple other people. Fired them. Finally returned to Boyce and Hart because Boyce and Hart seemed to be the only one that could get any work out of the Monkees.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently these four guys, as much as you'd like to believe, they were just cute little TV stars with cute little haircuts. That were sort of the Beatles light.
With cute little egos,
yeah,
I imagine.
They were jerks, apparently,
right.
And were not real good in the studio, but Boyce and Hart could apparently get things out of them.
Well, I imagine they probably already had some animosity toward Don Kirshner because he came in. I mean, how much stroke, Doc, do you have to come in to tell the band what chord to play?
Well, it had nothing to do with the band. It had to do with Screen Gems.
Mm.
Remember, Screen Gems was bringing in Don Kirshner,
right.
who already had a track record about 15 miles long of producing 11 million hits.
Right.
And so they bring him in, and the Monkees have already proven that, look, they're not all that great.
Yeah.
Now, remember, the show isn't on the air yet.
Okay.
So they've produced this album. Out comes the album, the Monkees, and it's not doing so bad.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that Kirshner has said, great.
Yeah.
We're getting hits. Last Train to Clarksville, Theme from the Monkees, getting hits. Here's where it all starts to go bad.
What?
The Monkees are on tour. And one day, they start walking around a record store.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what they see? Their second album. More of the Monkees.
Oh, what?
It was produced without them knowing it. Kirshner took all of these songs that they were working on.
Yeah.
Edited them, put them together. They had to buy it with their own money. The cover art was a JCPenney ad that the Monkees had actually posed for.
Wow.
And they were absolutely furious over this thing. And this is where Michael Nesmith calls the press conference that a lot of people know about. If you don't know about it, I'll tell you about it in just one second. Remember I said Neil Diamond wrote for the Monkees?
Yeah.
Here's his hit for the Monkees. I'm a Believer. Tell you what happened with Michael Nesmith in just a minute. Rock School.
I thought love was only true in fairy tales. Then for someone else, but not for me. Our love was out to get me.
Okay, so the Monkees are furious at Don Kirshner.
Well, rightfully so.
What do you mean, rightfully so? They're having hit after hit after hit.
But I mean, so if you and I head down to the Walmart after
the Monkees were what they were. They were a television show band.
Uh-huh.
You know?
But I mean, to do all this and not even let them know about it?
I don't know. Maybe yeah, maybe no. Michael Nesmith calls a press conference, and major places show up. A lot of places didn't, but two major places show up, Time and Look magazine. Now, Look's a defunct magazine, but at the time, it was a rather large magazine.
Yep.
Refers to the album as the worst album ever recorded. It's got three major Monkee hits on it, but he says it's the worst ever recorded. You know that big thing about the Monkees are not a real band, they don't play their own instruments?
Yes.
It's Nesmith's fault that happens. If they'd have just kept their mouth shut and maybe negotiated, there probably wouldn't have been much of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But it's from this press conference where he says we're being passed off as something we're not. Look, we play instruments, but we're not playing the instruments on the album. It's Nesmith that basically starts all of that kind of stuff.
Dummy.
There is more screaming and yelling and all of that. And for some reason, Screen Gems calls for the termination of Kirshner.
Huh?
Instead of, well, they're about to start the monkeys. They've invested all this money in the monkeys. The monkeys say, we're not going on the air. We're not doing this kind of stuff. So they call for the termination of Kirshner. Well, remember, Kirshner owns a third of everything. So he basically files a $35 million lawsuit and threatens to withhold all of the monkeys' master tapes literally the night before the monkeys debut on NBC.
He held them up.
That's right. Without it going to court... for an undisclosed sum of money.
That means a large one.
Actually, it's reported to be the largest out-of-court settlement ever made in the history of Columbia Pictures, which was the parent company of Screen Gems.
Wow.
Yeah. And away he went. Mm-hmm. And you can even look, if you want. You can look at all the Monkees' albums.
Yeah.
Their third album had a couple hits, and then it just dives off as if right into the deep end. Once Kirshner is gone, the hits stop coming. It's reported at this stage, the sort of the straw that broke the camel's back was that Don Kirshner brought the song Sugar Sugar to them. And when the monkeys told him to go pound sand, he gave it to another group called the Archies, which was a group of musicians put together.
Yeah.
According to what I read, that's not true. Sugar Sugar was always intended for the Archies.
Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe not.
Hmm.
But that's basically the story of Don Kirshner and the monkeys. He made them, and when they walked, when he walked away...
he broke them.
He broke them. So there you go. Here's another one from Boyce and Hart. I'm not your stepping stone. Yeah, that's appropriate, isn't it? Monkees, Rock School.
I'm not your stepping stone. I'm not your stepping stone.
There you go. Not your stepping stone, Monkees here on Rock School. And he still owned that third from everything I read.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt. If you're a good businessman, you put a clause in the contract that says, even after I leave, I get my third.
That meant last year, if they ran Monkees reruns on, like, what, TV Land?
Yeah, anything.
Money went to Don Kirshner.
He got a check.
Unbelievable.
That's awesome.
No trouble meeting the cable bill at the Kirshner household.
You're right about that.
Hello, WBSD, Burlington, Wisconsin. I know it's cold, but Green Bay's in the Super Bowl.
So that warms you up.
Just a touch.
Hello, Radio Universidad in Salamanca, Spain. Thanks so much for being a part of the Rock School Radio Network.
Back in a minute to talk about Don Kirshner's rock concert, one of the my formative years. Oh, God, did I stay up late to watch Don Kirshner's rock concert? Back in a minute. This is Rock School with about 15 minutes left in the show. Let me tell you the story of Don Kirshner's rock concert. This is what a lot of people probably know Don Kirshner for, or they know Paul Schaefer lampooning him on Saturday Night Live because his delivery, he was the host of Don Kirshner's rock concert. It wasn't just his name and then pretty people. He actually hosted it. Real stiff, you know, monotone delivery, just really just weird to watch him. But when Don Kirshner was working with ABC before 1973, he was working on something called an in-concert series that would run after The Tonight Show. And it was doing pretty well. What he did was actually get acts and traded them publicity instead of money. So if you were, say, Alice Cooper, because what I read kept saying Alice Cooper was a big fan of being on the in-concert series, he would pay him scale, like $300 for the night. And you, as Alice Cooper, would do it because you knew that there was almost half again or double the Tonight Show audience. You had the people to see you, which would mean, hey, there's Alice Cooper. He's coming to town. Let's go see him.
I can show off my skills. I can market myself. And therefore, in the long run, I'll make more money.
You got it. That's the whole concept. The thing was, the in-concert series became so popular that there were more people screaming to get on the in-concert series, which was, by the way, only every other week, that he went to NBC and said, look, this should be a weekly thing. And they said, you got it. Why don't you go ahead and set it up as a weekly thing?
Yeah.
So in September of 1973, Don Kirshner's rock concert goes live. The thing about Don Kirshner's rock concert is, unlike what was out there before, like Shindig and American Bandstand and the Soul Train. I'm not sure when Soul Train went on, but it was somewhere in the 70s. a lot of these people lip-synced.
Uh-huh.
Or they sang over a track.
Sure.
Kirshner would not allow that.
Good for him.
You had to perform, mm-hmm. and you had to perform live.
That's good. You know, Doc, it could have gotten to the point to where they would probably pay him to come on the show.
A lot of times. As a matter of fact, when I get back, I'll tell you the story of him negotiating with the Rolling Stones, because his first live act on Don Kirshner's rock concert was the Rolling Stones.
Yes.
Now, dig this.
What?
Here's Rush, back from 1974, and a song called Best I Can from Don Kirshner's rock concert. If the drums don't quite sound right, it's not Neil Peart.
Who was it?
It's John Rutsey.
Why?
This is because it's from 1974. This is before Peart was even in the band.
That's right. I forgot that Peart wasn't in with him the whole time.
That's how old this is. The song's called Best I Can from Don Kirshner's rock concert. Here's Rush, Rock School. Okay, last break on Rock School as we talk about Mr. Don Kirshner. Mm. Oh, by the way, he had a rock label called Kirshner and little tiny rock bands here and there, but the big one from Kirshner was Kansas.
He had Kansas.
Yeah, he actually discovered Kansas. That was two rock bands from Kansas, and he pushed them together and said, you guys should be one rock group. Pushed
Carry
them
on, my wayward son.
That's right, or the point of no return.
Yeah.
The Don Kirshner's rock concert show went on September 23rd, 1973, with a performance by the Rolling Stones. The story, it was taped, by the way, in London. The story goes that the Stones had the ability to play for something like $500,000 that night. Don Kirshner calls them and says to Mick Jagger, so the story goes, I want you to play on Don Kirshner's rock concert and kick off the show. And of course, everybody knows who Don Kirshner is. And Jagger says, well, how much do you want to pay us? And Kirshner says, I'll give you $300,000. Jagger says, $300,000? He says, no, $300,000 for each of you. That's scale. That's really the story. And apparently Jagger's like, well, baby, you know, you're Don Kirshner. We'll do it. And he
Rock
did it.
On.
And he played that night. So they played a concert, obviously, taped it because there wasn't a live link up at that point in time, played the concert, and then in came the tape. And 300.
I'll give you $300.
What guts do you have, or other part of anatomy, do you have to say to Mick Jagger, scale's 300, pal. That's all you get. Well, all right, we're going to end on this one. Rock stars had such faith in Don Kirshner that they would even go on Kirshner's rock concert and try out new material. Here's Steve Miller Band, Fly Like an Eagle, and you'll even hear him say at the beginning of it, we haven't even recorded this one yet.
Wow.
So we're trying it out on you. Here is an early, early, early version of Fly Like an Eagle by the Steve Miller Band, and that's going to wrap it up. Hope you learned a little bit about Don Kirshner.
Rest in peace, Don Kirshner. You were amazing.
You betcha. That'll wrap it up. I'm Joe Burns.
I'm Chad P.
There you go. Steve Miller Band takes us home. Class is dismissed.
We're going to do a little thing for you right now. It's a new one. We haven't recorded this one or anything. It's called Fly Like an Eagle.